You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 24th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Ew.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, next weekend, we will be at Dragon Con.
Oh, boy. Atlanta, Georgia.
Always a lot of fun. We haven't been in a few years.
Yeah.
A couple years. Yeah, we went 2 years ago. Usually, we've been going about every other year.
Well, I've never been, so I'm excited.
Really? Ooh. You've never been to Dragon Con?
I've never been.
Kara's first.
It's sensory overload, Kara. There's so many people, just nonstop costumes. There's a Walk of Fame thing where they have a lot of people from like old TV shows and stuff.
Fun.
Tons of vendors, tons of like sessions of activity going on, like, you know, things you can attend where they teach you how to do stuff. They're talking about really interesting things, you know, from science fiction to,
costuming, how to make puppets.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many cool little panel things to go to.
It sounds to me like, you know, I've been to San Diego Comic-Con multiple times and I've always survived, and it's a zoo. It's crazy. But to the extent that it's become so exclusive that a lot of the people who attend don't even get to attend the things they want to go to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The lines are so long. It's all VIPs now. And so it sounds kind of like what Comic-Con in many ways used to be like.
Yes.
Yeah. Dragon Con's much more accessible in that regard. I mean, you may have to stand in a little line to get into something, but you'll get in. It's not like you're going to be shut out really of anything that you want to see.
That's great. Because I'm on a lot of panels. I know you guys are too, in the science track, the skepticism track, and I'm also doing something in the podcasting track. So it should be really fun.
Yeah. It's awesome that there is a dedicated skepticism track at Dragon Con, which I don't think exists at Comic Con or the other ones.
No.
Yeah, and also science track and a podcasting track. That's basically where we hang out. But it's good to occasionally slip over to one of the other ones.
Yeah.
And of course, we'll be doing a live show and we'll be doing a private show. So if you are going to Dragon Con, we have an SGU special private recording. This will be Saturday night at 11:30 p.m. in the Skeptic Track room. We've been doing this. We did this, our first one of these at Dragon Con a number of years ago, and they've been extremely popular. The listeners who show up all say that they love it. We have a lot of fun with it. We always bring special guests, you know, which we don't know who that those are going to be at the moment, but we have a list of people that are all awesome. But in any case, if you want to come to the private recording, what you do is go to the SGU, webpage, under Become a Member, then the link Support the SGU, then click the link that says click here to support the SGU. That will take you to the PayPal. And then send us, it's $75 to attend, so just send us $75. If you want to send a confirmation email to make sure that we know that that's for the Dragon Con private show, then do that. Every single one of these that we've held, every single one has sold out very quickly. So if you want to attend, I suggest you do that as soon as possible, because we limit the number. That's kind of the point, is that it's a sort of an intimate private show, and it's a lot of fun.
Cool. Yep.
Okay, Kara, you're going to start us off with what's the word?
The word this week is inquiline. Anybody know? Anybody heard it? Inquiline.
Does it have to do with horses?
It sounds like it, but it doesn't. It also is not an adjective. To me, it sounds like an adjective, like an inquiline something, but it's actually a noun. So something just is an inquiline. And what is an inquiline? Well, it's an animal that exploits the living space of another species, like an insect that lays its eggs in a pitcher plant or a barnacle that attaches itself to the body of a whale.
That is cool.
Very cool. It was recommended by listener Kate Lowry from Virginia. Here's some other kind of word forms. An inquiline takes part in inquilinism.
Whoa.
That is kind of the practice as a whole. And it has an inquilinous relationship with its host species. So that would be the other word forms of that. Inquilinism is a type of symbiotic relationship. It's often grouped under the ecological umbrella of commensalism. You may have heard that word probably back in school when you were learning like earth sciences. So that means that specifically in commensalism, one species benefits while the other neither benefits nor is harmed. So it's different in that way from a parasitic relationship.
Right.
Okay. The etymology of the term, its earliest known use was from the mid-1600s. It comes from a previous Latin root incolonus, which means to inhabit or dwell. So early on, when you see the word inquiline in literature, it's actually referring to just a lodger or an individual who's inhabiting a dwelling that was not originally his or her own. Not until 1865 did we see the term first used in an ecological or zoological sense to apply the same meaning to a specific species.
So would that apply to like all the insects that live in your house?
It actually, in one of the places where I looked it up, I think it was in Merriam-Webster, the definition example was a house mouse.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess so. So if a mouse lives in your house, that's an inquiline.
But if like the termites are destroying your house, then they would be more parasitic.
They would be more parasitic, I guess. But if they were living harmoniously with you or not bothering you, like spiders living in your house and eating some of the insects, they could be inquiline.
Inquiline.
Yeah, I like
it. Yeah. The commensal organisms is something that we talk about in medicine. That's like bacteria that live in your body that don't bother you. You know, they don't help you, they don't bother you, they just live in there. Commensal organisms.
Where do they live, Steve?
Mostly in your gut. Yeah, but on every surface, your skin, all your mucous membranes.
Wow, we have these little mites that live in our eyelashes.
Yeah.
Yes. I have friends that have an equiline relationship with their parents.
They have an inquilinous relationship with their parents.
They are an inquiline, right?
Yes, they are equal. I don't like that it sounds like an adjective, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's a noun, yeah.
Steve, I would think the bacteria in your gut would be more beneficial than...
most of them are symbiotic rather than commensal. Yeah.
But some of them may not be. Yeah, that's the interesting thing about it. There's so many different ways to categorize all of these interesting relationships. And I think we see that the terminology gets more and more complicated as you near the present historically, because before, I'd say, Alexander von Humboldt, we didn't even really have that's when we first even started to have an understanding that nature lived off of itself, you know, that certain aspects of nature would engage with one another, and that if one species died, that it would actually change the balance of these different ecological niches. So until we started to really understand the relationships between species, I think the terminology was a lot cleaner. And now there's all sorts of umbrella terms that stack and stack and stack. So you'll see a lot of synonyms. A lot of times you'll hear inquiline and commensurate species used as a synonym. But technically, inquiline's a little more specific.
All right. So we already have an update to the conversation we had last week with Fraser Cain. Remember, we talked about the premature announcement that there may be a rocky planet in the habitable zone. Habitable zone of Proxima Centauri. Or is it Proxima or Proxima?
I think it's Proxima.
Proxima Centauri?
I'd say Proxima.
But Proxima sounds special.
Proxima Centauri.
Which is the closest star to the sun. Not the closest star to the Earth. That would be the sun.
Yeah, trick question.
Yeah, but the closest star to the sun, 4.25 light years from our own solar system. So this would be the closest exoplanet and the closest Earth-like exoplanet. So Proxima Centauri is a red dwarf, which means that it gives out a lot less light than our sun, but it also lasts a really long time. So last week we talked about the fact that there was an anonymous leak that maybe the European Southern Observatory, or the ESO, may have observed a planet in the habitable zone around this star. And today, as we record this show on Wednesday the 24th, the ESO officially confirmed that, yes, indeed, they have found a planet orbiting close to Proxima Centauri.
That's great.
And not just that.
Yeah, so it's they discovered it through the wobble. You know, you can look at a star, and the star is moving towards you and away from you and towards you and away from you. So you could tell that from the Doppler shift in the light. And that means that it must be orbiting a planet in the plane that you're observing it. So it is actually moving towards you and away from you as it rotates around the planet. And this had a regular period of 11.2 days, which means the planet's orbiting around the star in 11.2 days.
Wow.
Are they able to determine how fast that is going? Or they,
sounds like it'd be really fast.
It sounds like super fast. It'd
be going pretty fast. But
well, it's not a big orbit. It's actually very, very tiny. It makes Mercury seem very far away.
Right.
Lengthy.
Right.
5% are...
It has a mass of 1.3 times that of Earth. Yeah, it's only 5% of the distance from its star as the Earth is from the sun.
So the gravity is very close.
Gravity is probably very, very close. And 9. So, the surface gravity, it's not linear with the total mass. It would be less than 1.3. It'd be like, somewhere between 1.1 and 1.3.
And so that would be 4.6 million miles away.
Yeah.
That's tiny. So close.
Yeah. So
that is incredible.
It's in the Goldilocks zone, so they cannot rule out that there is liquid water on its surface.
It's holy
possible.
Crap.
Yeah.
How cool is that? Right next door. You could throw a rock almost and hit it.
Yeah. So how long would it take for us to get a spaceship there?
Well, there's a lot of variables.
Depends on the spaceship.
Yeah, and how fast we can get that sucker going.
20 years, Jay. 18 to 20 years.
The tiny, tiny probes
wafer
that we accelerate with a laser.
Super powerful lasers.
Yeah. Yep. To get people there, tens of thousands of years.
No, not people. I just want to see video. I want them to go there.
Yeah, and stream it live.
We could get there in 20 years, but it'll take us 1,000 years to build a ship to deal with it.
No.
No. 100 years, 50 years? Longer than we want.
This is when we should be able to launch a ship like within a year and just check it out,
Yeah.
So is this the kind of thing, I don't know, that society might coalesce around? In other words, like trying to get, the manned mission to the moon was sort of like even though it was undertaken by several countries, it was sort of this grand idea of humans. I wonder if we'll have the same sort of drive and oomph to make sure that no matter what happens and anything else that happens on our planet and silly things that humans do, let's make a concerted effort to really, really get there.
Yeah.
Well, screw that. Getting there is kind of ridiculous. If you just getting any atoms there at all, it's so resource intensive. But if you want to see what it's all about, we should build observatories and satellites and whatever it takes to actually image this thing directly. I mean, we're kind of heading towards that point in time where we don't have to rely on gravitational tugs to infer the existence of a planet or an exoplanet. We could actually be able to image it. And now, sure, that's like engineering on a huge scale, but it's something that is achievable much more, a much more reasonable time frame than actually getting there in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, but how much can we learn from just imaging it as opposed to being there? What is the net difference there of those two?
Well, it's pretty big. I mean, you could actually determine the atmospheric composition, which would be huge, because if you find certain elements in the atmosphere. Like, I, what would be a big one? Methane would be a big one. If you see that, that's generally created by some sort of biology. That would be huge. So we could determine, if there's these biomarkers in the atmosphere, that would be huge. We could potentially image the continents and things like that. It wouldn't be the super high res thing that we're used to.
I'm sorry, Bob. That's not good enough.
Hey, dude, I'm just telling you that's the most reasonable thing to want, like within, your kid's lifetime.
I want boots on the ground or it doesn't count.
Boots on the ground, yeah.
So you know what they're calling this planet?
Proxima Centauri.
Wow. No, that Proxima Centauri is the star.
Proxima B. Proxima B.
Yeah.
That's what I said, yep.
Proxima B. That's
the
designation.
Yeah, is that common that B is
The star is A, and then the first exoplanets, B, then C, then D. That's it. That's the convention.
All right, but we need a really cool name that rivals the coolness of the word Earth.
Earth is a pretty cool name.
Aren't they loosely calling this Second Earth or something?
Earth 2.0. Really,
I feel like the journalists are doing that.
I don't know if that's a real good thing to do. Yeah, I don't know.
What was it, Babylon 5 alien? Centauri?
Yeah,
Bob, I have a great idea.
Yeah. Yes.
We'll let any company in the world that puts up $20 billion. We'll let them name the planet after their company if they put up $20 billion to pay for the mission.
Yeah, planet Coca-Cola.
I'm good with that.
Then I hope it's a Tesla or
SpaceX.
Hell, you could have Planet Gates. Planet Bill Gates.
Planet Gates. Yeah, you could do
that's
that.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Evan, didn't you just say that his latest, you know, value or net worth is $90 billion or something? He could do it.
That's what I read. Yeah.
Come on, Bill. do this.
A mere bag of shells.
Come on. That's Planet McPlanet Face.
No way. Nope.
Yeah. Whatever you do, don't let this be some open contest. Yeah. Yes, please. Lessons learned the hard way.
All right, Bob. Tell us about the Anthropocene. What is this, and is it, you know, what's going on
here?
It's,
is it an invasion of an alien species?
This is fun.
It's an epic.
We may be living in a new epic already, and we don't even know it.
When you say epic, what do you mean?
You will see, my friend. Earth scientists are finally ready to officially review with the 35th International Geological Congress the idea that we have entered a new geological epoch of Earth. They're calling it the Anthropocene.
So that's E-P-O-C-H.
Yes.
E-P-I-C.
Yeah. Epoch.
Yes.
Yeah. Rather than epic.
Yeah. Important distinction, yes.
An epoch.
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 So researching this, it really makes me think about people just love their labels, even when it comes, you know, to naming slices of time for the Earth based on, you know, major natural events. So technically, we are now in the Holocene epoch. Of Earth's history, but it's more complicated than that. There's actually four different types of designations. Each one is more dramatic than the next. So you've got eons, eras, periods, and epochs. So today we are in the Phanerozoic eon. We are in the Cenozoic era, the Quaternary period, and the Holocene epoch. And so what we're talking about here is changing that last designation, the tiniest one, which doesn't mean it's unimportant, from Holocene to Anthropocene. And that's actually what many scientists have been saying for years. I've been reading about this for years, that we're really in the Anthropocene. This is, Anthropocene was coined by Paul Crutzen, and, it means anthropos, means, what's right here, is man. And yep. Scene, C-E-N-E, is new.
New.
So actually, you should kind of be happy because if
Newman.
We were, because what?
God, it's new Newman. Man.
Oh. A man.
So,
new.
So the Phanerozoic eon, which we're in, that's the top level. That's like the domain, the highest level. So that's big, and we're in this eon because of what major event that happened. The explosion of multicellular life. That was clearly a major, major event, in Earth's history. So that's like a top level. But then for the era, the Cenozoic era, that's when, that's after the extinction of the dinosaurs. So that's big, but not as big as the introduction of multicellular life. So that's kind of how it goes. So be happy, because if we were entering something, over the top dramatic, like a new eon or era, then that would probably mean we wouldn't even be around to name it, because it would be such a major event. It would change everything. So it's good that the little guy, the epochs, change.
Like a gamma ray burst that sterilizes the surface of the Earth, something like
yes,
that.
Yes, that would be a new eon. Yeah. So I think the question is, do we deserve to be not only in a new epoch, but one named after ourselves? I mean, is that kind of totally narcissistic? But I think it's totally appropriate. Right. I mean, a new epoch named Anthropocene clearly implies that there's this awareness that humanity has essentially become the primary agent of geological change on a global scale. So that's why it's incredibly appropriate. So let's list some of them, shall we? If you science even a little, then you know that the dramatic rise in global temperatures is anthropogenic. See what I did there? There's also, humans have been linked to vast, scary numbers of extinctions of plants and animals.
Just the ocean alone is a horror show.
Oh, it is. And the list goes on. The nitrogen fertilizers and pesticides that we flood the oceans with are causing major issues. Even radioactivity. You could find radioactive particles. You can find them in the ground to this day, of course, around the planet, solely from the nuclear testing that was conducted in the 50s. So that's another thing. And one final one that I'll mention is my favorite. It's the techno fossils, which is, I just love. Have you guys, know
what? Are those ET cartridges that they buried in that in New Mexico?
Those no,
are
I wish.
Now, Ev.
I know.
I wish.
Saw a documentary on it.
Do you guys know what trace fossils are? Steve, you probably do. Okay.
Yeah, so like, are they microscopic? No.
Good guess, though. Trace fossils are basically the things that species leave behind, like dinosaurs leave footprints. It's not the dinosaurs themselves. It's what they leave behind. Worms leave burrows. So those are trace fossils. And humanity is the king and queen of trace fossils. We create millions of these things, you know, and it started with stone tools going up to, you know, iPods or whatever, iPhones. We create vast quantities of these. Well, if you looked at them, you would see this weird stuff. You would see things that are very rare in nature, like aluminum. You would find things that are unknown naturally, like molybdenum, and certain things that are, or lots of things that are completely novel, like plastics. It's just this weird stuff. So our robot descendants or alien conquerors in millions of years, they can come back down and look at the layers of the earth, and the human Anthropocene epoch will jump out at them like no other layer, like no other layer of earth preceding it. Now, you'll notice I said preceding it because I'm imagining now that the layers that could be potentially laid down in the next century or three could be even more dramatic. And so it hit me when I was thinking about this. If we're in the Phanerozoic eon, which marks the explosion of multicellular life, how long will it be, do you think, before we're in the Digerozoic eon, when digital life and artificial intelligence explodes? Wow. That would require, I would think, if multicellular life exploding requires a new eon, that could actually be a new eon. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Geologically speaking, soon, that's right? Like in a moment.
I love how you are taking such an optimistic spin on such a depressing story. I think it's really cool. You know, when you mentioned plastic, it really struck me. I remember reading a story about like ocean conservationists and researchers who work on species surrounding the ocean, and geologists basically coining a new type of rock. You know, we think of igneous rock or sedimentary rock, and coining a rock called plasticonglomerate.
Oof.
Which is so rough that they're actually finding these hardened structures that have like plastic threads and almost microscopic pieces of plastic burrowed in them. And I don't know if you guys know, but just last week, I think, or earlier this week was some anniversary of Ray Bradbury. I participated in the Ray Bradbury read here in Los Angeles, where we went to a square in downtown and read samples of his work, and his two of his daughters were there. And it was very cool. But I remember thinking, gosh, in like the 40s, Ray Bradbury was writing about plastic and like warning us about how toxic it is and about how much it would like just take over our lives if we let it. And
wow.
I think plastic is going to be one of the telltale signs of the Anthropocene.
Oh, sure. I mean, it will persist for millions of years in rock. Absolutely. So I want to end if you look into this topic, you'll see references to the term golden spike. And that's another interesting aspect to this, because if they decide that, yes, we are in the Anthropocene, which I hope they do, and I think they probably will, the next thing that they need to determine is, okay, when did it start? When did the Anthropocene start? And the two options that I've come across that seem most reasonable to me, one is the Industrial Revolution. Duh. I mean, that seems like the perfect answer, I think. The other one would be, and you can make an argument for this, is the date of the first atomic test. That something that may be more appropriate. And that would be appropriate in some ways. But I think the Industrial Revolution, I mean, to me, that was really the beginning of us kind of taking over geological ownership of the world.
I think this is all reasonable speculation. But the problem I have with it is that we're essentially anticipating what the Earth is going to look like in a million years. We're like, what will a geologist and archaeologists find a million years from now when they're looking back, you know, at our current time? And we don't really know what the answer to that is. We're just trying to infer. I think the one thing that is clear, and that there's nothing that we can do to change at this point, is the mass extinction that we have wrought on the world. This is whatever, like the sixth mass extinction. But everything else, it's hard to say, because, you know, like, you assume that we're going to have a greater and greater effect on the geological strata of the world going forward. But that may not necessarily be the case. if you look at the arc of technology, it may be more true when we look back on it that, you know, we're sort of passing through a very temporary stage.
Yes.
Where our technology is very crude. And, it, yeah. you know, it involves stuff like dumping CO2 into the atmosphere and making materials that don't biodegrade. And but then in 100 years, we may, as our technology advances, we may be learn how to have a much smaller footprint on the world. You know, I was reading today about, you know, scientists developed an artificial rubber that is essentially biodegradable. You could break it down into its constituent parts and then reuse it. So it's not just building up.
Yeah.
And we're engineering organisms to metabolize plastic. And we're actually, some of our technological advances are going towards mitigating the problems we've created with our technical.
Yeah, we may end up burning all of our garbage for fuel and for basic.
I totally agree. I think if our civilization ended right now, I think there would be obvious these techno fossils would be left, and we would leave our imprint for quite some time, some perhaps millions of years for some of this stuff like plastic. Yeah. But I absolutely agree that in the future, not only will we have a smaller footprint, but we could also undo the vast majority, not only the atmosphere, but also the garbage in the seas and in the ground, the radioactivity. We could expunge all of this waste that we would have left, you know, to these to our robot overlords in a million years. It could be gone. So I think that's a definite possibility. If things go well, I think that could happen.
But we can't undo the extinctions, though. That's the only thing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we might be able to de-extinct some things if we
got
to.
Genetic database.
So it's a bit premature, is all I'm saying, but it's not unreasonable.
Yeah. It was an interesting side discussion, I think, about the main topic. But I think it's definitely warranted that we, you know, the new epoch named Anthropocene. I think at this point in time that's certainly warranted, I would say.
All right, Jay, I understand that there is a 25th anniversary this year of something that we all know and love.
Just to right out of the gate clarify, I found people celebrating the 25th anniversary
of the World Wide Web.
World Wide Web. We'll get into the details. So there was a little bit of confusion about what day is the date to celebrate or whatever, but I did read a few news items, and I thought this was a really cool thing that we should, you know, discuss, mainly just to give a nod to the people who invented it and to what we can do today.
To Al Gore. Thank you, Al Gore.
Oh, he's going to go down in history. Is that what he's going to be known for? Wow.
So 25 years ago from today, Bob was still old, or 25 years ago. But very importantly, on August 23rd, 1991, the World Wide Web had its first web page published in the public, which means that it wasn't just internal to the organization that made it, that anyone could access it. That web page, which you can still see today, by the way, and I did
porn. Was it porn?
No. Shockingly, no, Bob, it was really just like black text on a white background with a few hyperlinks.
Is it still up, Jay?
Yeah, you could still
see it. What did it link to if it was the only web page?
Other internal pages.
Itself.
That's a good question.
But I recommend you go take a look at it. Now, this was all created by a computer scientist named Tim Berners-Lee, and he
Love
is a
him.
Graduate of Oxford University. And during his time at CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory, in 1989, he conceptualized the World Wide Web. And he wrote the first web client and server in 1990, and he also came up with the idea of, oh, I don't know, simple things like URLs, HTTP, and HTML.
Oh, that's all.
We barely use any of those.
And Tim's work was the beginning of what we know today as the Internet. We call it the Internet. A lot of people consider the World Wide Web and the Internet as the same thing, but they're not. And Steve and I were having fun talking about this today, about the idea that those two things have pretty much become interchangeable, but there is a distinction between them. So there was an Internet as far back as 1969, and that's considered a network that carries information between locations. The World Wide Web, though, is the actual information that we get that's transmitted over the web, like web pages, images, videos, etc. So the network, a network you could think of as like the roadways, and the web pages or the World Wide Web is more of the mailboxes that have the mail in them that you go to read, right?
Yeah.
Here's a disclaimer, dear SGU listeners. The following information contains a lot of estimations and comes from studies that took place one or more years ago. What I am about to list is intended to give us an idea of the scope of the internet. You know, please don't email me and you know, get down into the details. This is more for just a perspective on, you know, what our modern understanding of the internet is when we look back. So, to get this out of the way, about 4% of the internet consists of porn, not the popular 30% calculation that is online that you see a lot of hoo-ha about. 4%, though, that's a lot. It's quite a number of web pages. I could not find any statistics on the commerce aspect of porn, but I would imagine it's huge. There are over 1 billion websites on the web as of September 2014. A billion websites.
That's not even pages. That's just
Yeah, not internal pages. That's just websites. Right. As of 2015, there were 3.17 billion internet users.
Wow. Half the planet.
A little less than half the planet, yeah.
Yep. And, you know, that was a year ago, so I would imagine those numbers are up. Less than 40% of online traffic comes from people. Most of it is from bots and data scraping and hacking. That's all automated.
Wow.
Yep. Most of the internet traffic comes from bots. Think about that.
Non-intelligences.
We're already being taken over. We don't even know it.
As of 2015, 85% of American adults use the web. What the hell are the other 15% doing? What are they watching?
Well, Jay, I mean, look at our parents, Jay. I mean, they are not web users.
My mother just got her first laptop last year, maybe the year before, and that was the beginning of her web surfing and internet life.
Yeah.
So at age 68, that's where she started.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a good like age range where you could or could not use the web, right? They go either way. This one, we did bring this up at some point, but I just find this unbelievably entertaining and interesting. Internet trolls have been determined to actually be bad people. They're narcissistic, Machiavellian, psychopathic, and sadistic, as determined by researchers, one of which is named Aaron Buckles from the University of Manitoba. They did a pretty deep investigation, and that's what they found. I'm not surprised, but it's kind of scary.
I think I tend to think about it this way. We know that there are psychopaths out there. So, of course, they're going to just have, you know, use the internet, use the web as their playground.
I know, right?
Yeah. Why wouldn't they? They can anonymously F with people and cause mayhem. Of course they're going to do
that. It's the ideal situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Wild West, basically.
Estimated 70% of emails are spam.
Oof. Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Although my spam filters these days are damn good. They really do a good job of very little false positives and false negatives.
But the thing is, like, if you go to your – like, I use Google for my email, right? If I go to my – other folders that are filtering out all the crap. Mm-hmm. Wow. There's a lot of crap. You know,
yeah,
it just automatically, it just deletes on its own and stuff. But if you do look at that, yep, I agree. 70%
seems
about
right. Same thing with comments to blogs. I mean, like when I first started my blog, I didn't have any comment filter and it was unmanageable. It just fill up with bot comments. And now, you know, we have the standard filters in place and it's pretty good.
It's good.
It gets rid of all the crap and just leaves behind all the real comments.
Although I found an email from Saberforge in my spam folder, and I got really pissed because I don't have that email.
Yeah.
In 2010.
Criminal.
2010,
that was a big gasp.
Yeah. Right? Everyone's like, oh, my God. 2010, Finland became the first country in the world to make internet access a legal right. And associated with that statement that the UN considers disconnecting people from the internet a human rights violation.
Wow. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses.
I love The Great Courses Plus. I can find anything I want, practically on any subject, at The Great Courses Plus. Science, literature, history, economics. It's wonderful because I get to learn from experts in the field. It's presented by award-winning people who really know their stuff. And it's just a tremendous way to continue your never-ending thirst for knowledge.
Yeah, we just listened to the Higgs boson and beyond. It is such a fascinating story of discovery. Of course, we all know the Higgs boson, the particle/field that imbues mass to all things that have mass. It's just such a wonderful story and an amazing discovery. If you want to learn more about it, listen to The Great Courses Plus.
You know that we at The Skeptic's Guide are big fans of The Great Courses Plus, and we want you to experience it also. Guys, if you sign up as one of our listeners, you will immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of their lectures. So start your free month today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. All right, Evan, there was this article published recently about science communication and fighting against pseudoscience that is interesting, although I don't totally agree with it. But let's talk about it. Tell
us about it. Yeah. Oh, it appeared in The Guardian. It was written by a former biologist. He turned blogger. His name is Richard Grant. And the title of his article is Why Scientists Are Losing the Fight to Communicate Science to the Public. So I'll read a few things directly from the article, and then we can sort of comment on it as we go. He says that scientists and science communicators are engaged in a constant battle with ignorance, but that's an approach doomed to failure. Okay. He says that a video did the rounds a couple of years ago of some self-styled skeptic disagreeing, robustly shall we say, with an anti-vaxxer. The speaker was roundly cheered by everyone for sharing the video. He sure put that idiot in their place. Scientists love to argue. Cutting through bullshit and getting to the truth of the matter is pretty much the job description. Well, I kind of don't necessarily fully agree with that. But he goes on to say, it's not really surprising scientists and science supporters frequently take on those who dabble in homeopathy or deny anthropogenic climate change or who oppose vaccinations or genetically modified food. Brian Cox was at it last week performing a smackdown on a climate change denier on the ABC's Q&A discussion program. He brought graphs, knockout blow, and yet it leaves me cold. Is this really what science communication is about? Is this informing and changing minds, winning people over to a better, brighter future? I doubt it somehow.
Yeah, I had a lot of problems with this article. So I mean, I think the core point that he's making, that you can't just oppose belief in pseudoscience with facts. You have to understand the psychological motivation why people are believing that pseudoscience. Sure, that's absolutely valid.
Yeah, but that's also not new.
Exactly.
We all know that it's not a deficit problem. SciComm, the reason we're not as effective as we'd like to be is not because there's just not enough knowledge out there. We know that.
Right. Yeah. My problem was he's writing to science communicators, and he is about 20 years behind on the conversation.
That's how I felt. Yeah. It's like, where have you been?
Yeah, this is like, I remember having this conversation literally 20 years ago when we were really getting involved with this. And there's so much more nuance. There's so much more involved with this. When I just briefly put this up on our Facebook page and said that he's actually committing the problem that he's criticizing. You know, he's sort of talking at us and not to us and not really addressing the issue. So, like, for example, he's talking as if there is only true believers, but that's not true. You know, there's not only true believers. First of all, there are a lot of people who are in the middle, who are just undecided, who are just don't really know about whatever the topic is, like vaccines. Like, there are a lot of parents who are, they hear concerning things about vaccines, but they're not anti-vaxxers. And so just putting the correct information out there and opposing the anti-vaxxers has a dramatic effect on the public conversation. It's an incredibly valuable resource to people who just want to know what the facts are. And it absolutely does prevent people, I think, from going down that rabbit hole and becoming a conspiracy theorist or an anti-science denier or whatever. And also, there are con artists out there as well. That's another group. There are people who are exploiting the true believers or exploiting the community, exploiting the beliefs, the conspiracies, whatever, just to make money, you know, just to sell their wares, to sell their snake oil. And they absolutely need to be deconstructed and taken apart. Their claims need to be, you know, vigorously opposed. They need to be corrected. We need to have the correct factual information out there. At the same time, when dealing with groups of people who believe things for ideological, emotional, political, sociological reasons, we need to address them in the context of the reason for their belief. And we know that there's a backfire effect. People could dig their heels in if you make them defend their ideology. We've been through all of this. This is what we talk about all the time.
And so, you know, his article was just naive. It was just uninformed. As I was reading, I'm like, God, this really would have benefited if he actually spoke to a skeptic at some point, you know, who's been doing this for more than a couple of weeks. You know, his opinions might have had some depth to them.
Or a professional science communicator, somebody who does this for a living and who studies outcome effects and who, you know, talks to other science communicators. It was a little bit judgy, this whole thing. Like, when are what is this, the quote somewhere in here, he's like, how often is it that science communicators actually listen to the needs of their audience? And it's like, the number one thing we always say in SciComm is know your audience. It's the first thing every science communicator talks about.
Right,
so it's just so dismissive to act as though we're not. I think he's really getting upset at scientists who don't communicate.
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah. It's frustrating. It's frustrating. And also frustrating. Kind of, is it fair to ask, who is this guy? Who is he, really? Richard Grant.
I don't know who he is.
You know? Oh, he works in here it is. He's a former biochemist, cell biologist, structural biologist, now working in medical communications and founder of the independent blogging network, Occam's Typewriter. Okay, so he's just like one of the many of us, basically, instead of saying, here are the ways that many of us can improve, he's saying, wow, you guys all suck at this.
Yeah. Steve, I got the same feeling you did. This is very incomplete, way too black and white, not recognizing the broad spectrum of certainly, you know, people that where people fall along the lines of science, intelligence, or understanding science. In fact, he breaks it down and he gives basically two general reasons as to why he arrived at this conclusion. He says, first, in general, people don't like being told what to do. When the experts tell us how to live our lives, or worse, what to think, something rebels in people, especially when there's even the merest whiff of controversy or uncertainty. And then he says, the second point, is that on the whole, he doesn't think that people who object to vaccines or GMOs are at heart anti-science. Some are, but most aren't. People simply want to know that someone is listening, that someone is taking their worries seriously, and that somebody cares for them.
Yeah, I just don't agree with that.
I don't know where he arrived really at that point, or how he got to that conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's he's armchair criticizing and a community of people that he doesn't really understand. And, you know, again, I'm not going to like play the card like, you know, he doesn't have the cred to have an opinion. Of course he does. But if you're going to be judgmental about what other people are doing, you better make a good, sincere effort to understand what they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do have the advantage here. You know, the SGU is 11 years old. We've been doing this for 20 years. This is a very interactive medium. We get dozens of emails every day. I read dozens of comments to my blog and comments on our Facebook posts every day. We are interacting with people. We are interacting with a broad audience as well as our community. We have a much better idea of what people actually think and how they actually respond to what we say than this guy apparently does. You know, he would have benefited tremendously from talking to somebody who's actually involved, you know, in doing this. We just got an email today. I wasn't planning on reading this, but I'll just say it's from somebody, you know, whose name is Kim. I won't give her full name, who basically said, hey, I started out as an absolutely true believer, gullible, believed everything, and, you know, an impressive list of pseudoscience that dominated her life. Listened to our show, and then over time was totally converted into a skeptic. So he's just factually wrong that nobody ever gets converted, because we get these emails all the time. It's probably statistically a small number, but you can't say that it never happens. And in any case, that's not even the primary goal. The primary goal is informing people who are open to the information, who are not already true believers. So anyway, unfortunately, we encounter a lot of this sort of armchair criticism. It is, I agree with you, Kara, it's just being judgy. You know, he ends, the way he ends, it was so terrible. He's saying that, he said, most science communication isn't about persuading people. It's self-affirmation for those already on the inside. Look at us. It says, aren't we clever? We are exclusive. We are a gang. We are family. It's tribalism. It's bullshit. Yeah. I'm not saying there isn't any of that. Of course there is. People are tribal. We do have our communities. It is a source of identity. But it is so much not that. That is not what dominates
science communication and skeptical activism. It is absolutely about persuading people. We are sincerely interested in engaging in the conversation and persuading as many people as we can. And we're constantly self-examining and looking at published research to figure out how to better do it. And we talk about it all the time.
So, this is, I think, especially
in that piece that he was doing, he's guilty of the exact thing that he's criticizing.
He's also so fatalistic. It's not like he's really putting forth any better options. He's basically like, well, some minds won't ever be changed. It's like, okay, thanks. And then he sort of kind of throws Atul Gawande under the bus to some extent, who is honestly one of the most, I think, effective and sort of non-controversial medical communicators out there, you know? Like, his writings touch people who are absolutely religious or absolutely magical thinking, and they still can read his things and not feel insulted and take something from them. He's just a very good writer in that way. I don't know. Everything about it is a little bit like the worst of what it is to write a blog. You know, I think blogs are incredibly important and they're incredibly necessary, and good blogs can be better than bad journalism, but sometimes blogs can be very lazy. There was no reporting done in this. He never spoke to anybody before he wrote this.
Yeah, it's an opinion piece more than anything. And, you know, I don't know what The Guardian's all about as far as, you know, putting this out as a news article, but
it's a bit annoying because it doesn't say opinion and it doesn't say blog. It says science, Occam's Corner. Like, this is listed under science. It, obviously, Occam's Corner sounds like it's his blog that he has on The Guardian, but it's not really clear that that's what somebody's reading. So anybody who comes across this who doesn't know the difference between good and bad science journalism might look at this and say, oh my gosh, well, this guy, this is the state of things, not realizing that he never interviewed a single person or did any real reporting.
Right.
Ugh. Anyway.
Yeah, he also makes one last comment on this. He makes this very typical rookie mistake. I think we've sort of made this mistake and then fixed it because this is what the evidence shows. This the idea that people are resistant to facts in general, which is not true. What the evidence shows is that if you give people facts, they change their opinion. They change their opinion to meet the facts, unless they are already ideologically bound to one position. So people behave differently for emotionally held ideological opinions versus things that they don't have an emotional stake in. And so you have to deal with people differently in different contexts. But I mean, he was nowhere near drilling down to that level of detail, you know, in his article.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Kara, tell us about the latest Pew poll about belief.
Sure. So you guys may remember a report last year by Pew that detailed a really sharp decline in Christian affiliation and a growing number of Americans reporting themselves as, quote, nuns. That was part of a really big study called the 2014 Religious Landscape Study that was published in 2015. It included, at the time, 35,071 respondents. So what the Pew Research Group decided to do is a follow-up, a recontact study, where they found, or maybe they reached out to more, but they ultimately ended up having 5,000 individuals who they interviewed more in depth. Of those 5,000 individuals, 1,149 of those defined themselves as nuns or unaffiliated. So that was broken down into 426 different atheists or agnostics and 723 people who indicated that their religion is, quote, nothing in particular. The real purpose of the recontact study was part of a bigger question about whether or not people choose new churches, when they choose new churches or houses of worship. And so they found a lot of really interesting outcomes on that, how often throughout the lifespan people will go to a new church, what are the reasons that motivate them from leaving their former congregation and going to their new congregation. But within that, of course, they had all of these, quote, nuns. And so they found that there were a lot of really interesting things that came out of the nuns, and they N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. And they dug a little bit deeper and asked a lot of questions. So again, Just to be clear, as part of a big 35,000 people study a few years ago, they recontacted 5,000 individuals, but now I'm only going to be talking about the 1,149 individuals within that group who define themselves as unaffiliated. So here's some interesting stuff. The vast majority of these unaffiliated individuals say that they were actually raised as a member of a particular religion before shedding their religious identity in adulthood. So about 78% of those people that they interviewed that said that they don't identify with a religion were raised religious, which to me seems reasonable. I mean, my personal anecdotal experience, and maybe it's because I grew up in the Bible Belt, it's very rare for me to meet people who had no religion as they were growing up. Much more common when I actually met people with similar viewpoints that they had left a church earlier. The really, I think, interesting thing here is that what they wanted to do is know why. Why did you actually leave if you were raised religious? And they found that there were a ton of different responses because they actually allowed for open-ended responses. So I'll read you some quotes in a bit. But there were some themes that sort of clustered. The biggest one, the biggest response, which was about half, actually 49%, of individuals said that they left because they don't believe.
Yeah.
Which is pretty straightforward. I don't believe, so I'm not going to go anymore. About 20% said that they left because they disliked organized religion. About 18% said that they were just religiously unsure or undecided. And then only 10% of this group that identified as a nun or unaffiliated actually self-defined as an inactive believer, meaning that they still had those beliefs, but they either are non-practicing or they're too busy to attend. So there is still within that nuns group, I think, a little bit of a holdover of what I might not define as a nun. Or an unaffiliated. So that's kind of interesting to parse it in that way. Under the don't believe group, we found that many people said that they were disenchanted and that's why they no longer believe. Some people said they just are not interested in or they don't need religion or that their views evolved. But that was actually a very small number. And only 1% of the individuals overall said that they went through a crisis of faith. So it does seem like it was less common that something happened in their lives that really changed their opinion and more common that, as we were just talking about, it was a slow, gradual thing that happened through learning and thinking and coming across new evidence.
The internet as well, I'm sure, has.
Yeah, the internet probably had a big part of that.
Totally fits with what I would expect. You know, I think just it's largely generational. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the younger generations – it's funny that a lot of them – it's not like they're atheists. They're so – a religious, they're not even an atheist. You know what I mean? It's like they just
That's why they're
it's
adapting.
Not on their radar.
That's why they're adopting that like nun label. Yeah, I think that we're seeing a lot, or just I'm religiously unaffiliated. There is something interesting though. Remember how I said 49% of this overall group said that they just don't believe, and that's why they left. Interestingly, if they actually broke that down into the people who self-identify as atheist versus agnostic versus quote nothing in particular. Actually, 82% of atheists say that they left because they don't believe. 63% of agnostics say they left because they don't believe. And only 37% of the nothing in particular group left because they said they don't believe, which also makes sense.
Are you surprised by any of these findings?
No, none of this really stuck out to me too much. I mean, it's definitely interesting. I think probably what's more interesting is the overall thing, like Bob and I were talking about before we were on air, just the overall trends that we're seeing away from a specific religion or organized religion and into kind of a personal formulation of spirituality, religion, or lack thereof. It does seem like we're seeing an individualistic move away from these big groups. And I do kind of find that interesting because, you know, we hear about these studies all the time. A lot of naysayers will send us these studies and we'll actually describe them on the show where congregations, church groups, being in a community actually is correlated with positive health benefits. And so it is kind of interesting that we're seeing more and more people sort of leaving that organized community behind. And I think that's where we're starting to see some changes even within the atheistic community. Some people still like the idea that they're unaffiliated and they don't want to be part of a group, but you're starting to see some atheist groups meeting and even having kind of their version of a quote church, which of course is completely secular, right. But is still a group thing so that they can have that sense of community.
That's basically what secular humanism is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting.
I do wonder a couple of things when I see these kind of numbers. One is, you know, is this a long-term trend? You know, is this, you know, the arc of human history to become less religious over time, or is this cyclical, you know?
Yeah.
Wax and wane.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to get out of your time frame and to try to look at the big picture. Certainly in the last, I would say, couple hundred years, it seems like the power that religion has on our society, even in the United States, which is, you know, fairly religious for a Western country,
yeah,
it's definitely been on the wane.
Oh, for sure. With with, you know, understanding evolution, just advances in scientific thinking, that's been a big thing. And like you guys said, the internet, just being able to meet people who are like-minded that maybe don't live down the street from you is huge in feeling more confident in coming out.
And the second question I have is, and I think I know the answer to this, but is, as religion is on the wane, are people just replacing it with other forms of belief systems? This doesn't necessarily mean that people are, that there are more people who are being rational or who are rejecting all ideology or all belief systems. It's more that they're rejecting traditional organized religion.
So true.
Are they becoming druids and
warlocks? Just
and
new age stuff. Yeah.
I know. So in LA, it is very rare for me to meet people who are religious. I actually forget that that's a thing. You know, I grew up in a very religious part of the country in the Bible Belt. I live in LA. Most everyone I know is non-religious.
But yet, they're still spiritual.
If you dig deep, they're crazy spirit. Like they have, we have a university out here that's basically a cult. It's like a spiritual psychology university where people are studying like past life interactions and energy transfer and chi and all. It's, I mean, the woo thinking, the medical quackery and the kind of, quote, spiritual. And I don't want to misuse that word. I have a hard time with that word because I think it comes with a lot of baggage. I think that it's perfectly legitimate for individuals to consider themselves to be spiritual in a sort of Zen kind of way, you know, finding profundity in nature. Carl Sagan even used the term. I think you can talk about spirituality in a way that is not magical thinking. And then you can talk about spirituality in a way that's absolutely magical thinking. Oh, and we have a lot of those people here on the West Coast.
Yeah. Why can't everybody be like us?
And we wouldn't have to exist.
Oh, how sad.
Yeah,
we just vanish in a puff of smoke.
If the whole world were skeptical, I mean, you can't say no to that, but it would be interesting because we would not have to exist at that point. I mean, we wouldn't need a skeptical movement if there wasn't so much irrationality in the world. I'd still rather have the rational world, though. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noise. What is that?
Trash compactor?
Chemical reaction.
That's pretty good, Ev. What else do you know about chemical reactions?
What do you mean? What do you mean, what else do I know about?
All right, the sound you just heard. That was SpaceX Falcon 9 first stage booster landing on the drone ship May 4th.
Oh, so cool. Shit.
The JCSAT Fit Mission 14.
Wow, 14.
It's a muffled sound because it was shot with GoPros inside their protective case.
That's
but
neat.
You could clearly hear the crackle of a jet engine, guys, of a rocket engine. Their crackle noise is like so distinguishable. So what happened? Nobody guessed it. Somebody wrote in, James Koltas wrote in, it's a rocket engine test fire. Close, but not 100%. Close. But thank you, James. I expect more from everybody globally.
Globally.
So this week's noisy. So Bob, you know Todd Weekly, right?
Sure.
Todd sent Good in guy. This noisy. If you don't know, Todd's a friend of ours. He's been helping us on many of the shoots that we did, including the Ox shoot. He's a great guy. And he came with us to the Star Trek tour last month. Still high from that, by the way. So check out this one. This one is really cool.
It sounds like the orchestra warming up.
Interesting. Oh, interesting. That's a good guess.
So it had an instrument, like string resonance sort of sound to me.
Yeah, I really felt it. You know what I mean?
Harmonica kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Yep. Harmonics.
Interesting guesses, everyone. So if you have any idea what that is or you've heard a really cool sound this past week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Hey, we have a name that logical fallacy this week, but before we go on to that, I just want to remind everybody that you can support the SGU. Do you know how you can support the SGU, Jay?
I do, but I don't know if everyone out there does.
Well, in lots of ways, actually. You could help spread the word, get other people to listen to the show, but you can also become a member. You can go to our membership page on our website, and there are various levels. If you join at the premium level, which starts at just $8 a month, you get access to our premium content. As often as we can, we put up extra content. So I know what you're thinking. You can never get enough of the SGU. Well, we'll give you even more as a thank you for being premium members of the SGU.
We also give our members early access to buying tickets, or they get first dibs on anything. Anytime we sell seats to anything.
Yeah.
Members came to the Star Trek event with us. You know, we try to give as many perks as we can. So we really appreciate it. If you become a member, we'd be happy to give you those perks.
All right. Name that logical fallacy, a very popular segment that we don't do often enough. I actually got two separate emails within about a week asking basically the same question. I'm going to read them very quickly. First one comes from Sean G. in Springfield, Oregon. And Sean writes, I frequently have difficulty with woo believers who spout absence of proof is not proof of absence as a means to support whatever feelings they have for a totally unsupported claim. This often is in regards to something that either can't be studied scientifically or something that has, like homeopathy, but they either refuse to believe or don't understand the research that has been done. The believers are asking the skeptics to prove a negative. It seems to also be symptomatic of the problem that no one trusts actual experts or can't figure out who the experts are anymore. It seems these people have decided unless their bottle of homeopathy has a big red label that says does not work 100% BS on it, they will continue believing. And the next email comes from Mike Score from Los Angeles and writes, I just finished listening to this week's episode and have a question about logical fallacies. During Bob's segment on the possible new fifth force of nature while talking about the new hypothesized particle, he mentioned that it has been well within our technological limits for years to find such a particle, so if it exists, we would have found it by now. Bob, please understand I am not picking on you and make similar arguments myself. Usually when debunking possible UFO claims as in, if aliens visit us, how come they have never been seen by either professional or amateur astronomers, despite the thousands of such people searching the sky around the world every night? Thinking about it now, it seems as if I might be making a logical fallacy there, but I can't seem to pinpoint which one.
Hmm.
So, they're both kind of asking a similar question about arguments based upon the absence of evidence, and what does that really mean? What do you guys think about that? So do you think it's a fallacy? Do you think it's a logical fallacy to say that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence? Or is it evidence of absence?
No, of course not.
Of course not. Which one?
Right.
I'm leaning towards it's not a fallacy, but I'm not. I have to look at my fallacy chart.
Yeah. So remember, the logical fallacies that we often talk about on the show are informal logical fallacies,
right,
which means they're not always wrong. They're not always invalid. It all depends on context and how you use it. So I often will say, because people say that a lot and they feel like they're being clever, they'll say absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Well, in fact, it is evidence of absence. It's not proof of absence. But it is evidence of absence.
Evidence.
But evidence exists on a scale, right? It's not like it's black or white. It's not like we've proven that this doesn't exist. So I think the best way to think about this, and I tell this to my medical students all the time, because, you know, often we make diagnoses as a diagnosis of exclusion, right? Sometimes our working diagnosis of what a patient has is based upon the absence of evidence. Is that when you are basing a conclusion, a diagnosis, an argument, whatever, on the absence of evidence, it's only as good an argument
as how thoroughly you have looked for that evidence.
Gotcha.
That's the key.
If you've done a really thorough survey and you haven't found anything, you can't say that that's meaningless. That means something. It doesn't mean you've absolutely proven that something doesn't exist, but that absence of evidence, despite a thorough search, can be very compelling.
Sure. Right.
On the context.
I mean, homeopathy, I think, is the classic example of that.
Sure. I mean, there's been 3,000 studies looking at acupuncture, and they have yet to prove that it works for anything. That doesn't prove it doesn't work, but that's pretty compelling evidence. That, if it did work, you would think by now somebody would have been able to show one clear-cut indication where it clearly works with repeatable clear outcomes.
Habitable.
And also what you're saying mimics the scientific process as a whole, right?
Sure.
Like generally speaking, when you set up a scientific investigation and you put together a hypothesis, you don't set out to prove your hypothesis correct. You set out to disprove the null hypothesis.
Yeah, falsify it.
Right.
Yeah, you have to falsify in science.
Yeah, and or you can look at it in terms of risk, right? Like the anti-vaxxers will say, prove that vaccines cause zero harm. Well, there's no such thing in the universe, right? You can never prove zero harm. All we could say is that there is no evidence of harm. And then you have to quantify the evidence. You can actually do that. And in fact, statisticians can look at, the data in a meta-analysis or a systematic review or whatever, and set statistical limits on how big a risk there can be given the negative evidence for a risk and how much it's been looked for. Because we can't rule out that there's still a small risk, but it's got to be smaller than this amount. Because if it were bigger, it's overwhelmingly likely the studies would have shown it by now. So that's a perfectly valid line of argument. But you just have to put it into the proper context. So what Bob was saying is that given, all of the searching that physicists do and the smashing together of particles and everything, if this fifth force existed and was of a certain magnitude, it should have been a signal that cropped up in previous experiments. And if it hasn't, that's curious. That's evidence that maybe it doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. It's a red flag at least.
Yeah. And it's not about proof. As soon as you start throwing the words "proof" around, you're off the track, right?
You're talking absolutes.
Yeah,
right?
You can't prove the negative. The absence of evidence does not prove the absence. But it is evidence. Also, you can't dismiss the absence of evidence if you've looked for it. Now if no one's looked, or if the searching should not have found it, then it's an invalid argument. So the classic example, this is a thought experiment, but this is often used. So imagine you're dredging the ocean with a net. The distance between the lines in the net are 1 inch apart. So basically, again, just hypothetically, any creature, any fish or living creature that was less than 1 inch long would slip through the net. So if you do that and then survey all the life in the ocean, it would be erroneous to conclude that there are no fish smaller than 1 inch in the ocean because you didn't find any. But your net would not have captured them in the first place, right? So it's an obvious example to make a point. If the evidence should not have seen it, then the absence of evidence doesn't mean anything. But type of research that's been done, probably should have seen it and it's still absent, that's meaningful. That is evidence for absence. Absolutely. And right. And for people who do science and read studies and, apply science, like in medicine, this becomes obvious. We literally make diagnoses based upon the absence of evidence.
But it really is, it's a skill, right? Like we talk about this kind of way of thinking all of the time. It's not something that you can just will yourself to have. You have to just do it over and over and over.
Yeah, it's a skill.
And read about it. Yeah, it develops just like anything else.
Right. But I also do say, though, that when a conclusion is based entirely on the absence of evidence, there's always a question mark there, too. Like when you're making a positive statement based upon absence of evidence.
Yeah, like there are no unicorns in Ecuador.
Yeah, or I consider that's a negative statement. You're saying there are no unicorns.
There are none. You're right. Yeah. You're right. Okay.
But like I'm saying, the patient has this disease because there's no evidence of these other diseases. I'm making a positive statement based upon the absence of evidence. That's always tricky. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just that you always got to have that question mark there. It's always much more reassuring when you have actual positive evidence.
Sure.
Because if you allow yourself to build the case entirely on negative evidence, it's just too easy to convince yourself of anything. Again, Carl Sagan had the classic example of astronomers looking at Venus and not seeing anything and concluding that there were dinosaurs living on Venus, right?
Right.
Okay, let's move on. It's time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week? Three regular news items.
Okay.
All right, here we go. These are interesting. Item number one, a new study finds that rat whiskers contain chemical receptors that help them to smell. Item number two, in a study, researchers find that chimpanzees choose cooperation over competition at a rate of 5-1. And item number three, scientists report a case of a patient who went from minimally conscious to fully conscious after stimulating his brain with low-power ultrasound. Bob, go first.
All right, the rat whiskers, sure. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. I can't think of any reason why that, would you call it smell? I could see that. I could see that. The second, let's see, chimpanzees choosing cooperation over competition, 5-1. That's, that kind of goes against what I've been led to believe about how, if you said bonobos, I would absolutely agree with you. But chimpanzees are definitely more on the uncooperative, irascible scale.
Irascible.
Scientists, let's look at number three. Minimally conscious to fully conscious after stimulating his brain with low power ultrasound. I just kind of love brain stimulation. I think I know it's not, doesn't necessarily do what they've been claiming over these years, but I think, I still have read some interesting experiments that have surprising effects. So I'll tentatively go with that one. Cooperation over competition, 5-1. All right. I'm going to say the chimpanzees fiction.
Okay. Jay.
This one about the rat whiskers that contain chemical receptors. What I can't figure out is how is the chemical receptor in the rat whisker communicating back to the brain? There's no electrical type nerve connection from the organ, the receptor, to the brain. Unless it's, I don't know. I just don't see how that can possibly be. It seems completely BS to me. The second one here, researchers find chimpanzees choose cooperation over competition. I don't know about the rate of 5-1, but I do agree with that, and I think that makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to say that one is science. And this last one, minimally conscious to fully conscious after stimulating the brain with a thing that Bob has hidden in a drawer next to his bed.
Apparently it's not hidden.
I just want to make sure Kara was awake. That's all. That's why I said
I'm
that.
I'm awake.
So stimulating the brain brings people from minimally conscious to fully conscious with a low power ultrasound. I agree because this reminds me of what it's like when I wake up in the morning and that's my coffee. So sure, this is possible. I just don't think the rat whiskers and the chemical receptors and then helping them smell thing. No, nope, I don't agree. That's fake.
Okay, Evan.
So the patient went from minimally conscious to fully conscious. I suppose those minimally conscious is a technical state of some sort. Not a coma or like totally
out? Yeah, it is a coma, but I mean, minimally conscious is pretty self-explanatory.
Okay. Now you stimulate the brain, but with a low-powered ultrasound? So how did they do that? Or why does a low-power ultrasound have that ability to do that? I don't really understand it. This one's tricky. The next one, the middle one, chimpanzees choose cooperation over competition as a rate of 5-1. I think that one will be science. I don't think there's any problem with that ratio. It may seem high, but, you know, chimpanzees are very cool. Very cool. How closely related in our DNA are we to chimpanzees? 98.8%.
Depends on how you count. Yeah. Depends on how you count it. There's no one objective answer to that.
Yeah, but it's very high.
Somewhere between 96 and 98% is a usual figure that the scientists.
Okay. Make. All right. Fair enough. Well, okay. I think, you know, people, although they're competitive also, I think we do have a lot of cooperation. So I think we kind of mirror that. I think we're okay there. And the last one is the rat whiskers, the containing chemical receptors. So I'm going to, this one I'm having a problem with because I'll go back to what we were talking about before with the logical fallacies. Isn't this something we would have figured out maybe a long time ago? You know, rat whiskers, it's not like some hidden thing or we weren't able to, what prevented us from determining this a long time ago? So I think we would have found the evidence for that a while ago. So therefore, I think I'll agree with Jay. I think the rat whisker one is going to turn out to be the fiction.
All right. And Kara?
I think I'm torn between rat whiskers and the consciousness situation. So I'll start with the chimpanzees. It seems reasonable to me. I've seen a lot of primate studies going all the way down to, you know, monkeys, not even apes, that show high rates of competition and of helping get food or share things in order to maximize the benefit for the group. So I'm going to say that one is science. Do rat whiskers contain a chemical receptor that helps them smell? Well, I'll disagree with Jay because that is what a whisker is. It is an organ. It's a sensory organ that actually helps with like proprioception, or it helps them navigate their environment. So if you cut certain whiskers, you can do all sorts of interesting neurological studies where you change some of the representation on the sensory cortex. So there is a direct connection between whiskers and the brain, but chemical receptors is interesting to me because I don't think they have a physical way to bind anything. I mean, that would be what the receptor is, but it would be crazy if they just now found that because rats are such a common laboratory animal. And then scientists report a case of a patient who went from minimally conscious to fully conscious. Okay, so they woke up after using low power ultrasound. I think I've seen cases where consciousness is kind of sparked with thalamic stimulation. It'd be crazy if you could do this from outside the brain, and usually ultrasound is delivered from it. So, I mean, I want this one to be true. So maybe, this is hard. I'm going to hope that the ultrasound is also science, and that the fiction is the chemical receptors on the rat whiskers, because I just think they would have found that sooner. That would be my reasoning.
Okay. So you all agree with the third one, so we'll start there. Scientists report a case of a patient who went from minimally conscious to fully conscious after stimulating his brain with low-power ultrasound. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Yay. Right. Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, that was
yeah.
Cool.
And Kara, great job. You pretty much nailed a lot of the details there. This was thalamic stimulation.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
The thalamus.
The thalamus. So this is, first of all, I was very careful in how we worded this. This was a single case, and they can't prove that the stimulation is what did it, just that the patient woke up after they stimulated him. But, you know, the timing does look good, but they'll have to obviously replicate it to see how generalizable this effect is and if the effect is actually real. But let me throw in some caveats here. First of all, this is a patient who was in a coma because of trauma. Trauma patients have a much better prognosis than patients who, for example, have diffuse anoxic ischemic injury. So if your whole brain is injured because of lack of oxygen, these types of things generally don't work. But if you have trauma to the brain, there may be like pieces of the brain which work and other pieces of the brain which don't work. And this is sort of a classic scenario where probably the cortex was relatively spared and was still pretty functional, but the cortex just wasn't being activated by the deeper structures like the thalamus. And so if you could get the thalamus, if you could kickstart or jumpstart the thalamus, which is what they're calling it, if you can get, you can use it, do it with drugs, you could do it with wires, you know, with deep brain stimulation. If you can get that thalamus to function more, it can wake up the rest of the brain, which is actually not that bad off. Does that make sense?
Isn't it crazy how like tenuous that is?
Yeah, right.
Oh my god!
These little centers deep in your brain, sort of alerting your whole cortex, and if they get taken out, you're in a coma. Yeah, and your whole brain could be perfectly normal, but you're just essentially permanently asleep because you don't have the mechanism to alert or wake up your brain. So in those special cases where that's the problem, this kind of thing can work. There was also a study where they implanted a chip, basically, you know, to stimulate the thalamus and the deep structures, and that also can be effective. Eventually that may be the intervention. But this is now using just an external low-power ultrasound focused on the thalamus to stimulate it. And the patient, so they described the patient as being, again, minimally conscious. They would be able to do some things, but not much. You know, they occasionally would attend, you know, to external stimulation. And then after the treatment, they were essentially awake. They would look at the examiner. They did a fist bump, you know, it was reported on one of the doctors as they were walking away. They would follow commands, participate in their feeding. Still not neurologically normal. The guy still has brain damage and, you know, was minimally verbal. I think would just like shake his head yes and no, would you know, do so appropriately, but wasn't really speaking. So, you know, again, just he woke up, but was not returned to like neurologically intact. But yeah, I think I do think that we're going to see fairly soon these types of interventions to treat this one subgroup of patients who have enough brain function to be awake, but their deep structure is just not working well enough to alert the brain. And then all we need to do is stimulate it and get in order to get them to wake up. And we're just figuring out the different techniques for doing that. Yeah, but very, very cool.
Very cool. Yeah. This is like, maybe this could work for other people. I know it's a very specific case.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll go backwards. I guess we'll go to number two in the study. Researchers find that chimpanzees choose cooperation over competition at a rate of 5-1. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob. So yeah, this was a little surprising actually, because previous research seemed to indicate that chimpanzees in particular are very competitive.
Yes.
Yeah, that they're greedy. You know, chimpanzees are often described as greedy, like they can't inhibit their need to take things. They'll steal, they'll cheat, they'll freeload, you know, and they'll compete against each other for resources. In this study, though, researchers tried to do a more of sort of an open-ended experiment with in a more natural group environment. So they had 11 chimpanzees who were involved in the study, and essentially they gave them tasks to do that would result in a reward. But the task required either two chimpanzees to cooperate or three chimpanzees to cooperate. One chimpanzee could not get the reward by themselves. And they just observed their behavior. So, for example, you know, did the chimpanzees work together? And then did they police themselves for theft or freeloading or competition? And in fact, they did. They engaged in a lot of policing behavior or enforcement strategies. For example, they wouldn't expose the rewards if a chimpanzee who had previously freeloaded was hanging around. They would say, nope, not until we get this jerk out of here. We're not going to do it, you know? Sometimes the more alpha males would get involved in policing and punishing and ejecting the previous freeloaders or thieves from the area. So they essentially enforced cooperation collectively as a group through punishment and these kind of behaviors, which is what humans do, right? That's essentially our system of justice is largely about enforcing social norms and, you know, living together, cooperating, etc. And lots of other animals do that too. You know, birds, a lot of birds do this. You know, if, you know, birds will, for example, some species of birds will warn each other if predators are coming. But if one bird doesn't participate in that, then other birds won't warn them when it's their turn. So that, you know, they use reciprocity as a way of awarding and punishing, or rewarding and punishing this behavior. So, you know, even birds do this. So cooperation is actually fairly widespread in the animal kingdom, but it is not unique to humans, although some researchers have argued that our level of cooperation is unique to humans. But every time somebody says that, you know, it seems like we find that chimpanzees do it too. And this is, you know, a similar case. Chimpanzees were mostly cooperating and engaged in a number of behaviors to enforce that cooperation on the group.
So that's nice.
Cool. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Somewhat cool.
Yeah. All this means that a new study finds that rat whiskers contain chemical receptors that help them to smell. That is complete and total fiction. So the whiskers themselves are basically hairs. They don't have nerves in them. They have nerves at the base of the hair that sense the movement in the whiskers.
Yeah, but you're saying there's receptors in the whiskers.
Yeah, but that was where I made that up. That was wrong. That's a lie.
Yeah.
Whiskers are just hairs.
A lie.
They are like vibroreceptors at the base of the whiskers. So the rat can sense, you know, they get sensory information to their brain that actually helps them map the world when those whiskers move. What the new study that inspired this item, though, was a study showing that rats can use their whiskers to sense the direction of the wind, and that helps them follow odors, you know. So like if they're smelling something, they need to know what the direction the wind is blowing in order to track that odor back to its source, and their whiskers help them do that. The study very quickly was they had rats enter an arena through a door, and there were five fans. One of the fan was on and blowing, and the hole at the base of that fan led to food. The hole at the base of the other four fans did not. So if they couldn't sense the wind at all, they would have a 20% chance of guessing the correct hole out of the gate. But the rats were able to do it 60% of the time, not just 20% of the time. But in order to show that they were using their whiskers, they then cut off their whiskers to see how they would do.
Okay.
But they said that the cutting off their whiskers is painless. It's like cutting your hair. And they grow back. So there's no, you know, permanent harm done. So they would cut off their whiskers, and then their performance dropped by 20%. So they were still able to do better than chance, because there are other ways that, you know, to sense the wind. But their performance, you know, decreased significantly because they didn't know, they no longer had their whiskers as one of as a sensory organ. So they were. It's that this suggests that they were sensing the wind in part with their whiskers. That was the study.
Cool.
Yeah, but no, I looked it up. I couldn't find any evidence that they sniffed the air with their whiskers at all. I guess they could lick their whiskers.
That's what I was thinking.
If there's stuff like clinging to the whiskers, they could taste it by licking it. But the whiskers themselves don't have receptors on them, as far as I could find. They're just hair. All right, Evan, give us the quote.
All right, here we go. Our place in the galaxy, nor our galaxy itself, is special. Darwin has further shown that humans are a natural product of evolution by means of natural selection. The discovery of extrasolar life will demonstrate that even the last claim to being special will have to be abandoned. And those encouraging words were spoken by, Mario Livio. He's an astrophysicist who may be known to our listeners as the author of the book Brilliant Blunders and the Golden Ratio, the story of Phi, the world's most astonishing number. Because that book won prizes. It won the Pino Prize and the International Pythagoras Prize for Popular Books on Mathematics.
Stephen Jay Gould wrote about that a lot as well, that the arc of scientific progress is marked by smashing pedestals of human exceptionalism. You know, it's like, no, we're not at the center of the universe. No, we're not even at the center of the galaxy. No, we're not at the top pinnacle of evolution. No, we're probably not the only life in the universe. So Yeah, it's just that, yeah, human pride sort of tries to keep putting us back in the center of things, or to say that we're exceptional in some way, when in fact we're probably just statistically very ordinary. But that doesn't mean that we don't have whatever meaning or significance, because that's all subjective anyway. We make our own meaning.
Right.
And as you say, I think any sentient life, any life that is exploring its own existence in the universe, has extreme value.
And that we're aware of how this unfolds, and our perspective in regards to how, quote unquote, special we are in relationship to everything else in the universe.
Yeah.
The fact that we're aware of that, I think, and makes us special.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week, and I'm looking forward to seeing you all at DragonCon next weekend.
Oh boy, I can't wait.
You too. See you there. It's going to be great.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes, as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.